From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Business Week's chief economist, Michael Mandel, is not just rooting for booming technology-led growth these days. He's putting out an enemies list of that growth, and almost everyone is on it. Liberals, conservatives, environmentalists, moralists, even economists. Tonight on Point, the case for rational exuberance and why the future may be better than you think. But first, we begin with a closer look at remarkable developments in India. Today, Sonia Gandhi, who led her party last week to an upset victory in national elections, said she will not accept the job of prime minister. Supporters keep asking. So far, she is saying no. Scott Baldoff is South Asia correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in New Delhi. I asked him to describe reaction in India to Sonia Gandhi's announcement.
Well, there's a great deal of confusion, of course. We're getting a lot of mixed reports that there is still a chance to persuade Sonia Gandhi that if only the Congress Party membership and the workers who are outside of her house, even at this hour, people are still out there in front of her house protesting, begging, trying to get some ways into the palace and trying to get word in that they really would like her to take up the role as prime minister. But she gave a very firm answer, no. That she is not for her own personal reasons, but also she thought in the interest of the country, she would not take on the role of prime minister. And this just has a lot of Indians confused because they thought this issue had been handled by the election. 320 of the 540 parliamentarians actually support her. That is a much better mandate in some sense than the BJP had, the previous government. So it's very confusing at this point.
Sonia Gandhi has given publicly some very simple reasons. She said that she had often stated that the post of prime minister had not been her aim and that she would follow her inner voice. She said that that inner voice tells me I must humbly decline this post. What broader interpretation is being taken from her declining to be prime minister?
I think one of the things that had been signaled by the now opposition party, the BJP, was that a number of the more radical members of the BJP were going to go on a nationwide protest against the Congress government if Sonia Gandhi was the prime minister designate. She thought, apparently, this is according to some of the senior leaders inside her party, that it would be in the country's best interest not to give them that fuel, not to give them that reason, and to let the Congress party and to let the new government stabilize the situation and move on with governing.
Indira Gandhi, her mother-in-law, was assassinated in 1984. Her husband, Rajiv Gandhi, was assassinated in 1991. The Hindu nationalists were calling the prospect of a foreign-born prime minister a national shame. We know there's talk along these lines, but is it clear that Sonia Gandhi herself may have feared assassination?
Again, it's hard to know quite what the, you know, there have been rumors that this was a very big issue for Sonia's children, Priyanka and Rahul. They did not want to see their mother put into any danger, but you do hear rumors from people who would be in a position to know the feelings of the family, that this was a big concern for them. Sonia Gandhi herself, of course, was always reluctant to get into politics, was reluctant to let her husband get into politics when his mother was assassinated, when Indira Gandhi was assassinated. So it would not be an unreasonable assumption that safety played a role here.
I remember standing in the center of Delhi when Indira Gandhi was cremated and seeing Rajiv Gandhi deal with that, and then, of course, he died later. These were clearly large traumas for Sonia Gandhi.
Well, absolutely. She, in many ways, is India's Jackie Onassis. She is someone who has seen the toll that being a sort of a ruling dynasty can take on a family. And she obviously seems to have opted out of that for her own sake, at least, and perhaps for the betterment of the party. But again, there are some who worry that when a minority party that's been thrown out of power sets the precedent of deciding, outside of government, deciding who should or should not be the prime minister, that gives part of that outside party a great deal of power. And some Congress Party members are worried that this is the precedent that is being set here.
And what about among Congress party members and people who voted for the party? Was there an implicit promise, or more than that, in Sonia Gandhi's vigorous campaigning for the party that she would indeed become the prime minister? Is there a sense of bait and switch here, of betrayal?
There's a bit of disappointment, not necessarily betrayal, but you do get a sense of severe disappointment. Look, we fought very hard, say some of these party members. We fought very hard to overcome this very issue. We're giving up a little too early here. We need to fight this one out and fight a moral battle on it. And so you do get a very strong sense. This is the reason why they're out there on the streets even now trying to persuade her to come back, because this should be their moment of triumph. They should be deciding their own future. But then again, Sonia Gandhi never deliberately, ever explicitly said that she would be the candidate. She did say at some point in Hindi, that's the way things usually happen, but she always left it open as to whether she would be the prime minister's candidate.
But today she says she's not tempted by power, even as her supporters are signing letters to her in blood and threatening to commit suicide. There are reports we're reading that she would support Manmohan Singh, a former Indian finance minister, as prime minister in her stead. He is a Sikh and would be India's first minority prime minister, so in itself a significant step if it goes that way.
It would indeed be a big step. Manmohan Singh is also well known for leading the economic reforms under Rajiv Gandhi, and then later again seeing those reforms continue under Narasimha Rao, another Congress prime minister. This, in that sense, would quiet down the market. We've seen a lot of tumbling and toing and froing in the stock markets here in India over what's going to happen with the economic reforms and liberalization. By putting him into that spot, it tends to send the signal that reforms will continue. But obviously there is some symbolic value as well to having somebody who is not a part of the majority religion in charge.
Well, a great drama of democracy and dynasty there in India tonight. Scott, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Scott Baldoff is South Asia correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with me from New Delhi. Businessweek chief economist Michael Mandel is finished mourning the 90s bust, and he thinks you had better be too. The only way out of America's economic and fiscal woes is to grow out, he says. And the way to do that is to get back in the high-tech saddle and shoot for technology breakthroughs and the roaring growth they can unleash. Too many Americans have become naysayers, he says. It's time to get up and grow. Tonight on Point, Business Week's Michael Mandel on exuberant growth and the American future. Are you ready for another round after round of tech-led growth? Is this the way, the only way? And if it is, what's stopping us? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined now from New York by Michael Mandel, chief economist at Business Week magazine. He's author of the 1998 High Risk Society. In the year 2000, The Coming Internet Depression, called that one. And now his new book, Rational Exuberance, Silencing the Enemies of Growth and Why the Future is Better Than You Think. Good evening and welcome, Michael Mandel.
Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. So all kinds of exuberance and aggressiveness at the same time in this title, Michael. You're saying the future's better than we think, and it's good to be exuberant. It's rational to be exuberant, but there are enemies of growth out there. We'll get to that. I wish, first of all, you just describe for us what path you think the U.S. economy should be on. What target, what trajectory compared to the path it is on? Are you saying we're headed the wrong way?
Well, what economic history teaches us is that new technology is the only way to get strong growth. And the 1990s confirmed that. It was the internet that powered the boom of the 1990s, and which has left us a much stronger economy than we were before. And so looking forward, what we want to see is we want to see the next wave of technological breakthroughs, whether it should be in biotech or nanotechnology or new energy technologies. That's the only way that we're really going to be able to move forward, generate new jobs, and really create the sort of growth that we need to solve our problems.
Isn't this what America has historically always done? I mean, electricity, telephones, radio, automobiles, antibiotics, and all the rest, as you cite. Isn't this our track record? You seem to be worried that we won't do it again. Why not?
Absolutely. It's been our track record, and that's why we should be optimistic about the future. The problem is that there's far too many people, and I, as you say, I list many of them in the book, who turn out to be against technology-led growth. And, you know, this was a big surprise to me. I didn't think this before I started the book, but the more that I looked around, the more that it made sense that, in fact, there were people that were uncomfortable with it. And one of the groups that was most surprising to me was it turned out that most of the economics profession has a big blind spot when it comes to technology. Even though they kind of admit that technology drives growth, when it comes to the textbooks, when it comes to the public policy pronouncements, there's much, much more discussion about things like budget deficits and taxes, and almost no discussion of technology at all. In many ways, the people who you might expect to be the biggest supporters of technology, which are the economists, have turned out to be the biggest obstacles, and that's a real problem.
And you have named names here, some very prominent ones. We'll speak with at least one of them tonight who says you've read him wrong, but you're saying Paul Krugman, Gregory Mankiw, the Harvard economist and current chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, Marty Feldstein, Alan Blinder, and right on down the line, enemies of growth. We'll see how they respond. But before we go there, I want to get a clearer picture of what you're describing. A lot of Americans lived through the 90s. Many prospered. Lots of boats were raised, real income growth and all the rest. But there was quite a cliff at the end of that, and I think it's left a lot of people gun-shy. So how are you suggesting people think about exactly what we saw in the 90s boom and bust?
Think about the boom and bust as a whole. So say over the last 10 years, we had the boom and then we had the bust. And let's compare. What it turns out is that growth was faster over these 10 years. The stock market is 150% higher. Incomes are higher. Poverty is lower. And let me ask you a question. Do you think unemployment now is higher or lower than it was in 1994?
1994. I guess it's lower now, but I don't have the exact number.
It's almost a full percentage point lower. The fact is that this 10 years of boom and bust, okay, was really a terrific period when taken as a whole. I would do it again and again and again. Now, the one difference is that I think that government policy should concentrate on making people more comfortable with technological change. That means things like putting in a better safety net, fixing the tax system to sort of help out people whose incomes go up and down. Really, you want to make people more comfortable, but at the same time, our politicians should be making much more of a case for technology.
And I guess I'm still stumped at why that's not just naturally happened. Are you suggesting that a long gray line of economists is standing between the mighty American innovation engine and the future somehow?
Let me ask you a question. What's happening to R&D spending in the government? The answer is that the latest Bush budget calls for a fall in non-defense R&D spending over the next 5 years.
You're blaming economists for that? That sounds like government policy.
Well, what do economists do? Economists propose government policy, and what they've done is they focus all the attention away from technology. And I believe in the power of economists. I believe that economists have power over economic policy. And if you spend all your time talking about the budget deficit or talking about taxes and none talking about technology, well, you shouldn't be surprised then at the results that you get.
Alan Greenspan warned of irrational exuberance. You're embracing rational exuberance and saying, let's take the thrills and spills. We'll be better off in the long run.
That's absolutely true. The fact is that new technologies always bring booms and busts with them. They bring lots of turbulence. They bring lots of people losing their jobs, being forced to shift to other things. And that's a good reason to sort of have some distress. However, you know what new technologies also do? They also generate new jobs, new industries, new companies, and that's where the real job growth comes from in the U.S. That's what we saw in the 1990s.
We're talking tonight with Michael Mandel. He's chief economist at Businessweek magazine, author of the new book, Rational Exuberance, Silencing the Enemies of Growth, and Why the Future is Better Than You Think. You can join our conversation tonight. Is this the way? Is it the only way? Are you ready for another round after round of tech-led hyper-growth, or are you gun-shy? Are you still wincing from the 90s bubble bursting? Have Americans grown skeptical of growing their way to glory? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a gloom-busting view of the U.S. economy, the case for high-tech-driven, pedal-to-the-metal economic growth in America. My guest is Michael Mandel, chief economist at Business Week magazine and author of the new book, Rational Exuberance, Silencing the Enemies of Growth and Why the Future is Better Than You Think. You can join our conversation tonight. Is the U.S. economy hobbled by enemies of growth? Do you buy that? And are Americans game for the huge dislocations that come with tech-led growth? Is the public prepared to grow the economic safety net to buffer the blows of high growth? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Steve is calling from Ashtabula, Ohio. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Great, thanks. Just great.
I am really on the opposite side of this. It seems to me that the title of the book, Enemies of Growth, is wrong in its premise. I mean, it's not that people like myself are enemies of growth. We see it as there's an end game here. You aren't going to continue to have continuous breakthroughs in technology like we've had for the last 100 years.
Why not, Steve?
Well, because you're just not. We don't need them in the first place. I mean, what possibly could we want? What possibly could we develop?
Well, for one thing, maybe an alternative to oil. We're going to need that pretty soon.
Well, that's a great idea. I mean, not just a great idea, but that's an essential. I mean, because
but isn't that an example? I mean, isn't that a technology breakthrough that we could use that would help things?
Absolutely. But the whole idea that you're going to invent the automobile, reinvent the automobile, the whole foundation of science and technology was built over the last 100 years, and you just aren't going to continue to have that kind of growth in technology.
Steve, I'll get Michael Mandel to respond to that, but if we don't have that, where do you see the growth we need to keep up with the growing population, to keep up with the growing demands of Social Security and Medicare and everything else? Where's it going to come from if not science, technology?
I think that the whole premise of growth economy has run its course, and we've got to do some serious thinking as to how we are going to have sustainable, even growth. Where people can feel secure in their jobs, where if we're ever going to get to a point where people have economic security again. This man mentioned the fact that incomes were up. Well, yeah, they were up for a small group of people, but the rest of us, if you believe these inflation figures.
Yeah, I think we got it, Steve. Of course, they rose for a lot of people, but maybe not in the same degree. But we've got your point, and thank you for bringing it to us. Michael Mandel, you know that the range of responses to your message is very broad these days. I mean, we've heard among guests on this show, Paul Ehrlich was on just last week saying, you know, we've got to have a different kind of economy here. It can't be based on endless high growth and so on. This conversation can't be had in a narrow vein anymore. Unpack what you heard in our caller's comments and give us your response.
Yeah, I agree that it's not a narrow conversation. One of the things that I mention in my book is I talk about the attitude of environmentalists towards growth. And I mentioned that there's a group of people, like the caller, who simply think that growth is not a good idea, that we have to have sustainable growth. But let me actually point out something. If you think about medical care, the only way that we're going to sort of solve the medical care problem going forward is to have technological breakthroughs that allow us to provide medical care at a lower cost. Otherwise, we're just going to have rationing.
May I just respond to that one for just a moment? Because mm-hmm. I see all kinds of room for innovation here, and I pray that it comes. On the other hand, a friend who's very high up in thinking about healthcare said to me recently, you know, there is no technology that can get us out of this healthcare cost trap. We've all got to just go out and take a walk and lose some weight and get healthier, or we can't afford it no matter what comes down the pike.
That is simply a wrong statement. You see, people can't visualize the next round of technology. It's always true. Technology is unpredictable. It's very hard to fathom what's going to come next and what's going to work. And so what we sort of see is the enemies of growth come in a lot of different forms. It's the people who think there's nothing else that's left to be invented. It's people who think that there's no technological solution. It's people who think even if there is one, it would have bad side effects. And so this book is very much addressed towards dealing with all of those people in the broadest sense. This is not simply an economic question. It's a moral question. It's a question of what sort of society we want to have. And it's really very broad.
Michael Mandel, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation one of the economists that you've put on your enemies of growth list. Alan Blinder joins us from Princeton, New Jersey. He's former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve, former member of the President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors. He's a professor of economics at Princeton University. Alan Blinder, thanks for being with us tonight.
Hi, glad to be here.
You see the title of the book. I don't know if you've had a chance to get to it yet. You know you're on Michael Mandel's bad guy list here.
I saw myself in the rogues gallery, yes.
There you are. Are you, or have you now, or have you ever been, Alan Blinder, an enemy of growth?
Never. Neither card-carrying nor otherwise. And very few economists are, actually. Some of these debates that have been happening over the decades, not just recently, over whether growth is, on balance, a good thing or a bad thing, have typically had economists all on one side saying it's a good thing, with a very few exceptions, and a variety of other sorts of people, such as Michael mentioned, environmentalists and others, occasionally on the other side.
Mm-hmm. I know you think you've been quoted out of context by Michael Mandel here. I don't want to get endlessly into that, but we acknowledge it. But is there some angle in which you're sympathetic to what Michael Mandel is saying, Alan Blinder? Do you agree that somehow the American engine of innovation is hampered today? And if it is, why?
Is hampered, did you say?
Yes.
I don't think in any serious way. I mean, it can always be better. But as Michael mentioned in the book excerpt, we have very robust capital markets that fund innovative technology. Despite what you hear from a lot of people on the right, we have a relatively unregulated economy. It's not perfectly unregulated, of course, nor should it be. But there's a lot of freedom to innovate. We have a great ability for people with ideas to start companies, many of which fail, some of which succeed. We have a very good educational system at the top. Mm. In the middle and the bottom, it's not so hot and needs a lot of improvement.
So with all that, do you agree or not with Michael Mandel that technology-led growth, very strong growth, kind of breakthrough revolutionary growth in technology, can lead America out of this, what appears right now to many people to be a thicket of fiscal and economic challenges?
Well, yes and no. You got to think about the timing. I mean, the growth process as driven by technology is usually at a fairly slow rate. You're talking about, lately we're doing better, but productivity over long periods of time, you know, last 50, 100 years, has generally gone up only a little bit more than 2% a year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, over decades, that accumulates to a huge amount. It transforms the planet. But if you're thinking in 3-4 year frameworks, 2% a year is not that big a deal. So it's not going to solve some of these problems that we're facing in the near term.
Michael Mandel, does this sound like, as you hear Alan Blinder responding to your large premise, does it sound like an enemy of growth to you?
Alan is a very fine economist, and I very much respect him. The problem is that even though he sort of says in one sentence that technology is important, in fact, none of his policy prescriptions include this, because he says in the short term, it doesn't matter all that much. Let me actually just sort of mention one thing that sort of really struck me. In his textbook, in chapter one of his textbook, which is a very well-known textbook,
sure,
he says, what is economics? And he lays out the main themes and issues of economics. And do you know what isn't there? There isn't a single mention of technological change or innovation. So what I would love to see, Alan do is write an op-ed piece where he talks about the things that are necessary to accelerate technological change, which as far as I know, he has not done.
Alan Blinder, do we need a new explicit American emphasis on innovation, or is it baked in the cake of the U.S. economy and culture?
You know, I think it's largely baked in the cake. This is a very innovative society where people try things and fail and succeed. We spend a lot of money on R&D. You know, by the way, in terms of policy prescriptions for technology, that's what all economists always recommend all the time, because the benefits, while the risks are very great, on average, the benefits, the returns are very high. Now, again, I wouldn't say things are perfect, and I'm sure there's room for improvement. There's certainly room for improvement, as I intimated a few minutes ago, in our educational system. You know, not everybody gets to go to Harvard, Princeton, and Yale, and a lot of America's high schools are poor, and we don't turn enough out enough kids that are interested in science and so on. So, sure, there are things that we could do.
But do you think Michael Mandel's putting too much faith in technological innovation? As an economist, do you think he's overestimating the kind of escape velocity potential that he sees there?
No, I think there's a little bit of, as I'm sure he would admit, there's a little bit of hype. He's trying to make a case. I don't think so. I think in the long run, technology is the driver. The one thing I would say that I think is missing from the argument a little bit is a denigration by omission of what people call process innovations, just these little incremental things that make things better and better and better.
Yep.
Year after year. The Japanese had a word for this, Kaizen.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to the big breakthroughs, this process innovation, this incremental improvements of ironing out the kinks are very, very important.
Michael Mandel, this sounds like Alan Blinder's almost full embrace. Are you not feeling loved?
Not at all. What he's saying is that the innovation is baked in the cake, and what that means, we don't have to do any policy measures to help it. And that wipes it off the table. Now, this is exactly the attitude that I'm objecting to,
mm-hmm.
that, in fact, that there are things that we can do to accelerate technology, including increasing the spending for science and engineering education at the higher levels, including spending more on R&D, including things like supporting stock options, which are part and parcel of the high-tech sector. I think that, you know, this is really the reason I have to say why I put him on the enemies list, is that, and I read pretty much all of, pretty much everything that he's written over the years.
Yep.
And what it comes down to is that, yes, technology is important, but no, we don't have to do anything about it.
And you don't believe that it happens naturally. You think it takes a government support to fire it up.
I think it takes government support and it takes political leadership to maintain support for technology innovation, especially at a time like this where we're coming out of a bust. I think it's a very important part of economic policy and cannot be ignored.
You know, I'm fascinated. In addition to that support, which you want for spending R&D, basic science, and so on, you also lay out a very big agenda of social and economic safety net steps that you would like to see the government take. You point out that technology can be very disruptive. It can change jobs, destroy jobs, move them to other parts of the economy, to other parts of the world. You say, above all, we must strengthen the safety net to allow Americans to support technology-driven growth without worrying that it will rob them of jobs and benefits. You're proposing big changes in the way we pay income tax, so it's always averaged over a few years. So if you lose your job, you're taken care of, essentially a big extension of unemployment benefits, very large. In everything that you describe, you sound kind of like, to my ear, Michael Mandel, a Clinton Democrat, bridge to the 21st, 22nd century guy here.
Well, I wouldn't say that. What I would say is that I'm a firm supporter of technology-led growth combined with economic security, because I'm concerned with maintaining the political support for innovation. Because when you have new innovations, there's always the opportunity for government to regulate it, slow it down, as in the case of internet pornography and stem cell research and internet taxation and regulation of all sorts of new technologies.
But these are essentially GOP Bush-era steps you're describing. Can you imagine a Republican administration really building the big safety net that you think would bring Americans robust, exuberant buy-in for this kind of technology wild ride you want to go on?
What I think is that neither political party right now is correctly set up for this. You need both the emphasis on the technology-led growth, which more comes from the Republicans, and you need more of the emphasis on security, transparency, a level playing field, which more comes from the Democrats. There is room for a coalition of optimism.
I want to invite our callers in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Mitch is calling from Boston. Hi, Mitch. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi there. I think we need to go back to the future here. 100 years ago or so, a great economic work was written called Progress and Poverty, which really analyzed, I think, very profoundly why, with the advance of technology and innovation, the gap between the rich and the poor becomes even greater. And we've been seeing that, especially since the so-called Reagan Revolution, where all this wealth was created, but you had more homelessness, and which we still have. So I don't think it's just a question of progress or innovation, but how the distribution of the products of the economy are distributed in a fair way.
So are you saying, Mitch, you don't want to buy on to more tech-led growth until that gets figured out?
No, I think it all has to happen simultaneously. And I think the key is the tax structure. I think the current tax system penalizes productivity and it encourages speculation. This was Henry George's point 100 years ago.
Mitch, we've got it. Thanks for your call, Michael Mandel. Along with your safety net, are you concerned about income distribution here, or, hey, let's have the big gap as long as we have the big growth?
What is true is that when you have technology-led growth, that the people at the bottom do well as well. So the only time over the last 30 years where we've had a rise in incomes for the people at the bottom was during the internet-led boom. You can't say it anything better than that. And what I don't understand is why the people who profess to sort of be in favor of the people at the bottom don't say, let's do the 1990s all over again. Because the fact is the poverty rate went way down and wages at the bottom went way up. And there's no way to contradict the figures.
Alan Blinder, I know we've only got you for a couple more minutes here. I wish you'd reach out empathetically to our friend Michael Mandel and feel his pain. He follows all this pretty closely, and he's clearly frustrated that he doesn't feel buy-in, enthusiasm, rational exuberance about this tech-led growth, even from your field, economics. Why do you think that is?
I don't know why he's feeling so unloved. I mean, the truth is that economists since Adam Smith have been emphasizing technology as the prime driver of growth.
But has the mind wandered? Has it gone down into cubbyholes of tax policy and distribution and taken its eye off the main ball here or not?
Well, you know, the Lord gave us two eyes so we can look at two things or three things or five things.
Yeah.
It's not the only thing that's going on. For example, I don't believe, as Michael, I think, was just slightly suggesting, that this will guarantee equality. There are times when technology seems to be equalizing, as in the golden age after World War II. We had a lot of innovation and we had equalization. In the last 30 years or so, we've had a lot of, or 20 years, we've had a lot of innovation and we've had disequalization.
I don't know if he
can go either way.
Yeah, I don't know if he said equality, but that it lifts all boats, maybe not in the same degree. Alan Blinder, I wish we had more time with you, but I know we're out of it, and you're a pal to come on tonight. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Alan Blinder, professor of economics at Princeton University, former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve, and on Michael Mandel's Enemies of Growth list, we're talking tonight about a gloom-busting view of the U.S. economy, the case for high-tech-driven, pedal-to-the-metal economic growth in America with Michael Mandel, chief economist for Business Week magazine. His new book is Rational Exuberance, Silencing the Enemies of Growth, and Why the Future is Better Than You Think. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the case for high-tech-driven, pedal-to-the-metal economic growth in America. My guest is Michael Mandel, chief economist at Business Week magazine and author of the new book, Rational Exuberance. You can join the conversation. Is this the way? Is it the only way? And do you see the next tech miracle out there? Is it in energy, in biotech, nanotech? Where? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Michael Mandel, you're a good sport. I'm just trying to poke here to see exactly where you two disagree. Alan Blinder seemed to want to embrace everything you're saying, but you don't sound satisfied with it.
Well, what economists do, and I add Alan in this, what he does is he will admit that technology is important, but then say, well, it's baked in the cake. We don't have to do anything about it. Let's focus on monetary policy. Let's focus on budget deficits. Let's focus on taxes. Let's focus on elementary education. You notice when you asked him the question about what would he do, he sort of basically listed everything else other than technology. And that really sort of sums up the economics profession for the most part.
Economists are not entrepreneurs or technologists themselves. I mean, a better education system presumably would support technology breakthroughs.
Well, what you want to think about is what can you do directly to support it? There's really two aspects here. One is the policy aspect, What can you do in government? The other is the leadership aspect. What can you do to make people feel more comfortable with it, to lead the way? And there's so much that has to do with attitude that's important here. Do we embrace innovation, or do we reject it, or do we try to slow it down? And, you know, you had two of the callers tonight. One was objecting to the income distribution.
Yeah.
One was objecting to the idea of growth. And I think what you discover is that there's a lot of people who have a lot of uneasiness with technology. And the danger that we could run into is that we end up pulling back from it and looking more like Europe. Remember, Europe had very slow growth in the 1990s and even now, in part because it has a less flexible economy and it's less willing to embrace technology. That's just what's happening there.
Doesn't sound like the American instinct, but maybe you're onto something here. Let's hear from our listeners. Donna is calling from Titusville, Pennsylvania. Hi, Donna. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah, good to have you.
Good evening, Michael.
Good evening.
You sound like a good sport, and I hope you are. I understand what you're saying, and in principle, I agree with you. But my concern is that we, because of outsourcing, because of our lack of interest in maintaining the industry that we had. And when I say...
You mean traditional industry, Donna?
Traditional industry. I'm talking about steel, automobile manufacturing, wood. It seems like all of these industries are falling by the wayside. They're being... China right now, for example, is putting a huge steel mill online that will take up 50% of the entire world's scrap.
That's big.
That's very big. That's this year, and it's not even up and operational completely.
So you're saying never mind the technology frontier, we need to buttress the industries we've already got, Donna?
We need to start looking very hard at doing that. Our industry in this country, look, Michael, I understand what you're saying, and I agree that we need to continue with technological growth. But we also need to take a good hard look at what we have left in terms of being able to rebuild our bridges and our buildings and our roads.
Donna, stick with us and let Michael pick that up. Michael, what do you say to Donna here?
What I say is that most of the basic manufacturing industries that you're listing fell down a long time ago in terms of investing in R&D and investing in technological innovation. I leave aside the auto industry for a second. Okay, you look across most of manufacturing, and what you see is that there's been a long period of underinvestment in R&D, underinvestment in innovation. And one of the big reasons why the jobs are going overseas is that if we're not innovating, we have no advantage. See, what I would have loved to have seen is much more interest in innovation in the part of the companies that you're talking about, because in that case, there would have been less likely that all these jobs would have left. The fact is the Chinese factories that you're talking about have the same technology that we do. They have better technology in many cases, and that's because of a failure on our part to innovate in those basic industries.
Donna, let me ask you, if as Michael Mandel suggests, Americans were given greater something like income guarantees or buffers against the dislocation of job loss, would that make you more comfortable with swinging into new industries and seeing old ones go or be transformed?
Absolutely not. Michael has completely missed the point. Our workers don't work for $1.50 a day. The Chinese have purchased at auctions. And I know this firsthand because I've been at those auctions. I'm in that industry. I've seen the groups from China, they are purchasing our old equipment that was sitting in a stockpile in a corner that we didn't even use anymore. That's what they're using.
Because they can match it with low-cost labor and make it pay.
Absolutely. And then we don't put tariffs on it, or if we try to, we have things like the World Trade Organization coming in, slapping us on the hand, saying, oh, no, that's not fair. You can't do that.
Donna, we've got the picture, and we thank you for calling it in. Michael Mandel, you hear there the desire to drag a foot out of the car here, slow things down, and hang on to what we've got. I want to get another call or two in, if we may. Zach is calling from Natick, Massachusetts. Hi, Zach. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling, Tom, because I actually am wholeheartedly in Michael Mandel's camp in at least one point. I'm in the venture capital business, so I couldn't agree more of the importance of technology and innovation.
By definition, you're there.
Exactly. Long-term growth. However, I actually disagree with half of Michael Mandel's prescription, which is the active encouragement of the government or governmental policy in encouraging innovation. Because I think the private industry and both venture capital and the public markets do a remarkably good job of backing whatever good innovation ideas do exist in the marketplace. And I think if government actually gets involved in increased R&D spending and those sorts of activities, will actually end up misallocating capital more than helping it.
Michael Mandel, your response?
I love venture capitalists. I think that venture capital in the U.S. is one of the prime competitive advantages that this country has. The ability to funnel money to the fast-growing sectors is just remarkable in historical context. Having said that, I really think that the point that I made partly is government policy and partly it's government leadership maintaining the proper atmosphere for innovation. We've had this period now where people have been really down on Silicon Valley. They've been down on stock options. They've been down on IPOs. They've been down on things like stem cells. There's all sorts of things that people object to. And, the venture capitalists, in order to operate, must have an environment in which innovation is viewed as a plus.
So you're saying not that the government should be in the middle of it, but that they should help establish an environment, an atmosphere that's conducive.
Absolutely. The government needs to be, in terms of funding, needs to be at the basic research end, which venture capitalists don't fund. It needs to be at the education end, and it needs to be in terms of the attitude end.
Well, you hear the venture capitalist right there saying, fine, but don't get too close to what I do. Capital will do its job. Thank you. Zach, thanks for your call. Our time is short. Michael Mandel, in the minute and a half we have left, handicap the technologies out there. You list some that you see as potential boom growth sectors. What are they? Where do you see the best possibilities?
Yeah, there's five that I think is possibilities. One is biotech, which is almost to the point of the same point of maturity that high tech got to in the mid-90s. One is new energy technologies like solar and fuel cells, which we absolutely need. Nanotech may be a little bit further off. I list in my book commercialization of space, which is a real long shot, but has real potential. And telecom, too, could be a real breakthrough technology. Now, the main point is technology is unpredictable. We don't know which of them is going to turn out to be the big breakthrough, but we have so many things bubbling beneath the surface that we are fairly assured that one of them is going to come through.
And very quickly, what if it's not bubbling in the United States? What if it is bubbling in a university in China or India? Does the U.S. miss out?
I think that's a great thing, too. Ideas cross national boundaries very easily, and one of the U.S. advantages is we do have this great financial system that can fund new businesses, and in the end, money talks. And we will be in there as long as we let the financial system function.
Will we employ Americans if that breakthrough is funded somewhere else?
Remember that people had a lot of doubt in the early 90s, even through 95, that we were going to generate new jobs. If you have the new technologies, new jobs, new industries, new companies, it works out fine.
Michael Mandel, thanks for being with us. Being with us again, great to have you on.
Oh, very glad.
Michael Mandel, chief economist at Businessweek magazine, author of the new book, Rational Exuberance, Silencing the Enemies of Growth, and Why the Future is Better Than You Think. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, remembering actor Tony Randall. This is On Point. Tony Randall, best known to Americans for his portrayal of fusspot Felix Unger on TV's The Odd Couple, died in his sleep last night after a long illness. He was 84. Randall had a long stage career and appeared in several movies as the fussy foil for Rock Hudson and Doris Day. He played television's first gay lead character in the short-lived 1980s sitcom Love, Sidney, and was a regular on David Letterman's late-night shows. But Randall will always be most remembered for playing fastidious photographer Felix Unger opposite Jack Klugman's slobby Oscar Madison character in the television adaptation of the Neil Simon play The Odd Couple.
On November 13th, Felix Unger was asked to remove himself from his place of residence. That request came from his wife. Deep down, he knew she was right, but he also knew that someday he would return to her. With nowhere else to go, he appeared at the home of his childhood friend, Oscar Madison.
Randall won an Emmy for his portrayal of Felix Unger in The Odd Couple's final season, 1975, but only after the show had already been canceled, which led him to make this quip at the awards ceremony.
I sure am glad I won. Now, if I only had a job.
In his later years, Randall founded and financially backed the National Actors Theater in New York, which revived classic plays. Legendary entertainment journalist Army Archer was a longtime friend of Tony Randall. In this On Point tribute, he recalls what made Tony Randall such a great actor and why he was perfect for the role of Felix Unger.
Tony Randall was such a unique man. He was really, if we can use the phrase, a man of all seasons. And he put almost every guy's quirks and foibles and loves and hates and idiosyncrasies into that role. And so he just became so beloved.
You should never assume, because when you assume, you make an ass of you and me.
That was just one part of the Tony Randall that people really know, because he really was a part of everyone's involvement in show business, with his involvement in live theater from, that's 50, 60 years ago. I was talking to Jack Klugman. He told me that he'd known him since 1954 when he saw him on Broadway. He saw him in Inherit the Wind with Paul Muni, and he saw him in such Doris Day and Rock Hudson pictures in which Tony Randall co-starred, Pillow Talk and Lover Come Back and Send Me No Flowers.
She is the loveliest. She's the most talented person I've ever met. That's what you said when you married that stripper.
He was a very positive guy. He was positive about everything he said. He let you know, no uncertain terms, what he thought and what he was thinking of. And I guess everybody got to know about that when he made all those guest appearances on the late night shows. He really had a thing about smoking. And anybody who ever watched him on Johnny Carson show knew that he would even take a cigarette out of Johnny's mouth. He was really, really a strong-minded person. But he was also so kind and warm and loving. And when he got married again in late life, his first marriage was 54 years when his first wife, Florence Gibbs, died. And then he married Heather in 1995. And then they had two children. And when the first child was born to them when he was 77 years old, and Jack Klugman was telling me that they were doing The Odd Couple in London stage, when Tony got word that his wife was expecting, he ran into his dressing room, Jack's dressing room, and said, "The machinery still works." Tony Randall had many loves: his wife, his children, his fellow actors. But his great love was for the theater.
Army Archer is a senior columnist at Variety magazine and a longtime friend of Tony Randall. Randall died last night at age 84. Tonight, the marquee lights on Broadway are being dimmed in his honor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.